Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to go to an area that we really haven't dealt with in the seriousness and the depth that we should have, and it's something called psycholinguistics. We're going to be talking to a psycholinguist in the form of Paul Amrine, professor at Columbia University in the College of Physicians and Surgeons. Paul, welcome to Science Studio.
Happy to be here.
Before we get on to what you do, how did you become into the science and sociology, psychology? What were the formative years?
The formative years, I think I've always been a closet clinician, and I've always been interested in why people would tell me about their personal problems even when I didn't want to know them. And yet I was compelled to respond. And in combination with that and being a rather entrepreneurial sort of teenager who discovered the power of negotiation with vendors for whatever things teenagers like to buy, I realized that language was very powerful. And I put those two together and I thought to myself, maybe I should pursue understanding how people use language to solve problems, to get what they want, to get rid of what they don't want. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, I decided I needed to pursue psychology and linguistics. And I decided to study both in tandem because I had a sense, and my parents were quick to remind me that I probably wouldn't get a job with either one alone. And so I think the concept of psycholinguistics is just this hope that the whole will be greater than the sum of its parts.
Oh, well, I mean, that seems reasonable. But, I mean, it seems like you came readily formed out of the womb. You liked to negotiate for things you wanted. You were good at the words, and therefore you developed. So it was as simple as that.
It was – apparently I was properly reinforced for talking at the right time to the right people about the right things.
But you said you were a closet physician. Was there a time when medical school was expected and you that's what you were after?
Yes, there was a time.
So you didn't do well in the MCAT or something?
No, actually it's somewhere in the middle of my undergraduate training. As you may know, most undergraduates will quickly boast that they are either going to medical school or law school or maybe engineering. And then the truth begins to set in. Either your GPA isn't as sterling or you find a class that surprises you.
Yes.
And in my case, it was a class in psychology called experimental psych, and it was about research methodology. And it was more about research and less about practice. And I decided to take that path.
I mean, psychology has this duality. There's the clinical psychology.
Right.
And then there's the sort of research-oriented.
Right. But there was always a thought that I would end up in a psychiatric institution, not the way you may be thinking, where I would be working with clinicians and working with patients. And happily, that has come to fruition.
So. Okay. And so you work with a team of MDs when also then. I mean, it's
exactly.
You're not qualified. Well, not qualified isn't the word, but it's not easy for people at your level of education and research orientation to be let alone with patients, I guess.
No, thankfully. and so you have research teams, as you're suggesting, and you have psychiatrists and clinical psychologists who see the patients, and then I review and collect data from all the individuals involved in psychotherapy sessions.
Okay, so then this all started because you wanted to be a good bargainer to get things you wanted your way.
Something
right,
like
with
that.
Words. So, I mean, one of the areas that I could see is negotiation.
Right.
So, I mean, that must be a whole area of psycholinguistics.
It should be. Language provides us with many levels of information. Starting with what our speech sounds, what we sound like when we speak, whether we speak grammatically, and what we mean by what we say. And then finally, what we hope to obtain by what we say. And it's at that most abstract level where we see negotiation playing out. And I'll make a leap here. One can clearly cast psychotherapy as a case of two individuals negotiating.
And so psychotherapy is slightly different from psycholinguistics.
Clearly, that's true, but one has to ask the question: what is psychotherapy without talk? And that brings in the psycholinguist.
Right. So, before we get on to the psycho part, tell me about your linguistic sort of interests. Language by itself, for you, language is a medium for trying to help people. When we get to the therapy part, but linguistics by itself, do you just like words? Do you do crossword puzzles?
Yes. Yeah, I do the New York Times crossword puzzle religiously. I'm quite good at Scrabble. Wish there were more pieces.
Yeah. Well, we play Scrabble a lot in our family. And the doyen of the family, she's 99, can basically keep her head up and come always second or third, sometimes win.
Right.
You know, she's just amazing. And that, I think, keeps her active, you know, her brain active.
Well, of course.
I mean, it's a nice sedentary way to exercise your mind, in a sense.
Use it or lose it.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's true.
That's true.
And there's another game that she's introduced. It's three-dimensional Scrabble. I can't remember what the name is. But rather than building words, you know, on what's already there, let's say you've got rain. Mm-hmm. And you've got a certain number of points for rain, somebody before you. Mm-hmm. Well, if you can now use the N and put a tile on top with a D, so you've got raid, and then you can have another word down, dog, for example.
How nice.
Or doubt. And so you get double the number of points when you go one tier to another tier to another tier. Not as many tiles, but it's a fascinating game.
But it works.
Right? Well, and you've got to think in a totally different way.
Right. But to answer your question, I think in general, engaging in wordplay is apparently something I do without knowing. I like to author. I like to write.
Yes.
I obviously, therefore, like to read. And I think from that, I really gained a sensitivity for the nuances of language expression.
So do you like entomology as such, the history of words?
Yes, very much so. And if I did receive the classical training in linguistics, so I had my proper content courses in historical linguistics and the such. And so the notion of where words come from has always fascinated me. And in fact, where words are going, I find equally fascinating. And
you mean how the language changes?
How it changes, right. And how I believe, for example, things like swear words probably will not be swear words in 20 years because now they're in the popular culture. We'll have to look for new swear words, as I tell my students.
Well, I mean, a lot of the swear words in the Anglo-Saxon were just straight up and down words.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with blink and blank and whatever the other words that
right.
I'm not allowed to say here. So, I mean, so they've gone full circle.
Right.
So you think it'll be accepted, swear word, when the culture changes, when all the French came over in 1066,
that's
the
right.
Saxon words were relegated.
Right.
Now they're all going to come back.
There you go.
Because they're better words.
That's right.
Right? I mean, fornicate is one word and the other word,
which
we,
and we don't say it. That's
yeah,
right.
Much, much more convenient. Well, let's go back a little bit then. Your thesis, your very first entry into research. What was your first project?
Commitment. I was studying how people express commitment in everyday language. And what I noticed was that we have a relatively small number of words we can use with which to commit ourselves in varying degrees to carry out some task either for ourselves or for someone else in the future. And there's a sort of a funny story in this. I was trained at a Midwestern Big Ten university, University of Wisconsin. It has often been chided for being one of the homes of Dust Bowl empiricalism, that you have the ideal minimal design where the outcome will be clear-cut whether it supports or does not support your alternative hypothesis. And you defend that design, and then you are given a degree, and off you go. And so for my version of that 2x2 design, I was allowed to work with four verbs of commitment. Promise, agree, hope, and guess. And happily, they do behave well, or the users of those words do use them in a way that is quite orthogonal and systematic. But there was a joke at time of defense of the dissertation as to whether I should copyright my dissertation. I raised the question, and one of the judges at the defense said, "Are you afraid someone will steal one of your verbs?" It would no longer be a 2x2 design, and all the statistical procedures would no longer work. But what I found there was that even in everyday conversation, individuals are very sensitive to the words that they will choose. And because if you think about it, making a commitment is a very limiting activity. When you commit to something, to do something for somebody else, that means you can't do something beyond that until that promised act is carried out. And so we will be often will hedge on our commitments. So instead of saying—
That's where the hope comes in.
That's where the hope, that's where the guests with the shrug. There are gestures that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the dissertation was well defended and then kind of became dusty on the shelf.
I published
the dissertation, right. but its audience was more, oh, that's a nice study, and your results are clear-cut, and goodbye. So,
but goodbye with a PhD.
Goodbye with a PhD. That's right. And I had other irons in the fire. I was doing other research at the time, working on issues of aging and dementia, as well as visual cognition and so forth. So I was a busy experimental psychologist. But once I had my first tenure track appointment at the University of New Mexico, a person came knocking on my door one day, mid-90s, and unbeknownst to me, he was one of the purveyors of this psychotherapy regimen called motivational interviewing. And he said, Paul, I understand you study commitment. And I said, I think about it a lot and I have one paper. He said, well, I have an idea for a proposal that you might find interesting. I think what you have to say about commitment in everyday language and what I have to say about what happens during psychotherapy when the goal of the therapy is to change a person's current unhealthy behaviors, in particular substance use, alcohol, and so forth, I think we may be able to understand more about what works and what does not work in psychotherapy. What do you think? I was amazed. Here was my home for my right. dusty research ideas. And so we wrote this proposal, and the federal government funded it, and the rest is history. And it's good.
The point that you made at the beginning of that story, the concept of patenting or
copywriting.
What would that have meant to you? I'm not sure I understand what that means.
It's traditional to copyright your dissertation with the idea that if anybody decides that there's computer software that they could use that would take your ideas. It's intellectual property.
Okay, just the ideas there.
It's just the idea to protect yourself. Because,
so are most theses copyrighted?
Yeah, I think they are.
I mean, I know mine resides somewhere in some, I don't know where it is to tell you the truth, but it's Ann Arbor.
Yeah, University of Michigan.
Yeah, they got this whole, every thesis ever written seems to land up there, no matter which country you did the thesis
in. And I think in your case, in mine, they were reduced to microfiche.
Yeah, right.
Right. with a very small
least,
letter C.
They haven't been reduced to dust, not quite
not
yet anyway.
Okay.
So anyway, then you found a home.
I found a home for my research.
And a collaborator, which also makes it more exciting in one sense. You're no longer the isolated man in the isolated ivory tower.
Well, sometimes when you have an interesting idea, it is half of a really good idea.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. We're halfway in our program also, so it's a good time to take a break. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Paul Amrine from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. We shall be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. As I age, I think about my mom's advice to me many years ago. Don't get old.
How's that working for you?
Some days it's better than others. What she meant was do all the right things to stay healthy and delay dementia. In 40 years, the global dementia cases are expected to triple. And despite all the medical advances, there's still no magic bullet.
The upside is epidemiological studies show we each can delay our own mental decline. Enough studies have linked dementia with low physical and mental activity, obesity, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. One recent study reinforced the strong correlation between exercise and a robust mind. Walking, running, and weightlifting are all effective.
A lot of older Americans now use computer games to pump up their minds. A study did show it improved their language and reasoning skills for at least a year, but other studies show the positive effects decline with age.
Many people believe in nutritional supplements. While there's no conclusive evidence they work, in a few cases they do. For example, in people with nutritional deficiencies, vitamins do improve cognitive abilities, especially B12 and folic acid.
But people with normal levels of these vitamins and take more don't experience a delay in cognitive impairment. In fact, mega doses of supplements can be toxic. Another study found adding omega-3 fatty acids, such as fish oil, has a small effect on verbal abilities and no effect on motor skills or memory.
So for now, your best bet is what you hear most often. Get physical and mental exercise and maintain a healthy diet and weight.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Paul Amrine from the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. And we're talking about psycholinguistics. We're talking about words that have some vague idea about commitment. That was Paul's first beginning. And that developed into a program now of using psychotherapy and using the words and the commitments and the statements to try and treat people in one sense or another. Go into that in a little more detail.
Okay, well, one of the natural things that seems to arise during a psychotherapy session of any stripe is that the client or patient feels compelled to talk well of what they will do once the therapy session is over. There's a demand characteristic that they will change.
Well, they just want to get out of the
interview. They at least want to get out of there. And so that environment is very rich for commitment making. Now, what's important for both the client and the therapist is that the commitment making that finally emerges is, in fact, truthful, sincere. A good therapist will allow the client to make wonderful, wishful statements of their future behaviors and then get down to the work of, why did you come here today? You're telling me you have an issue, a problem you would like to work on, or your boss is telling me, or your spouse is telling me, and so forth. And let's talk about why you are doing what you're doing, as well as where you would like to go with this. And a good therapist will then engage the client to talk about their desires. Why do they want to drink? Why do they want to stop drinking? Why do they feel they are able to continue drinking? Well, you know, I can afford it. I have a good salary. My brother gets me cheap beer every Friday. How do you think about your ability to stop drinking? Well, you know, for about a year, I went dry, and it was okay, and I actually got a new job, and so forth. So the therapist will bring out these what's called the underpinnings of commitment making. You feel you want to. You feel you can. You have a need to make a change. Maybe now is the time. There's readiness. And you have reasons supporting all of this. Through the session, what will happen is the client will become more and more emphatic about this underlying information. Along the way, they will begin to rebuild commitment making that is closer to the real story. They may not make boastful commitments. I'm determined to stop at this time. They may be more reticent. They may be saying something like, I'll try. Those are the gems. Those are the moments that I will make use of in my analyses. And then we take that talk and we see if it in fact predicts future drinking, future drug use. And the nice answer is it does.
So what you're saying is you're having a conversation,
right?
I mean, as opposed to sort of a question and answer session,
right?
Although there are questions and answers in there, and then you're analyzing the words. So I mean,
exactly.
this is a computer based approach.
Well, you know, it started out being organic, and
right?
Now,
no, but
and
I mean, now the now number of times the word "try" comes in as opposed to "will" or whatever. I mean, is that that's the future of the field?
Well, yeah, and there's also it's not just how often it's said, but it's how strongly it's said. So, like I said in my old work, from going from hope to promise,
yeah,
you see that shift. Therapists tell me that my work has provided them a compass when they're in session with a client that lets them know where their client is going, not only in that room, but where they're going to go afterwards, almost literally.
So it's a predictor of behavior.
It's a predictor of behavior.
And so you're saying that the choice of the words is going to be a very good indicator. So, you know, if you've got a certain set of vocabulary words that you really like,
right,
you know, you can maybe use this more generalized than just in the concept of therapy.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
I mean, you start to analyze yourself or other people or use the language they use to see, you know, future activity.
Exactly.
Because, you know, that would be very interesting in an academic environment.
Of course.
Where you get people who have just got tenure and then seem to have sort of hit a plateau for one reason or another and have long conversations with them and then predict, you know, when are they going to come out of the post-tenure doldrums,
the scallop,
if ever.
Yes.
All right? This is – I like this.
It's good. It's interesting. I have also been told, though, when I train my graduate students to listen in on these sessions, I've been told that they can never, ever have a normal personal relationship ever again because they now analyze the language of their dates and their spouses and their partners.
Do students sit in with these, or are they listening to it remotely?
For ethical reasons, we listen to the actual – the recordings.
Okay.
The recordings.
Right.
And if and ideally, videotapes, but oftentimes people don't want to be on camera, the clients, and so then we listen to audio recordings.
Okay. Well, that's good. We shall analyze this program when we finished.
There we go.
Anyway, tell me about then the advances that you have seen in this field, where you feel now comfortable to make predictions of behavior in the future.
Well,
I mean, does it automatically mean that if you're going to sit down and have a therapy session, I guess I'd call it, that in fact at the end of it you're usually pretty clear about the outcome for that particular person in the future?
I'm thinking of my statistics. It's never a perfect prediction. It is a statistically reliable prediction. You can get to the point you can predict 60 out of 100 individuals.
Okay. So then that's predicting what's going to happen based upon the interview. But supposing, like usually, I suppose, in therapy, you want to influence the outcome. That's a different game altogether.
Right. Well, then what you want to do is look at the language at the beginning of session and the language at end of session. If the therapy has actually done something, if it really has been talk therapy, the talking has changed the person. Typically, the talk at the beginning of the session is about their current use. The talk at the end of the session is more about where they are going.
How long does a session take?
It can vary. It depends on how talkative the client is or the therapist is. Anywhere from half an hour to an hour.
Okay. And so then based upon that change of language, if there's no change in language, then what are you thinking here?
Maintenance. The person will probably stay the same, which might be good if they've improved their health practices before they walked in.
Mm-hmm.
It might be troubling if it means they're at a dangerous level and they're not going to move from that.
Does everybody want to be quote-unquote cured? I mean, you get people who have got a drinking habit, for example, or some other drug habit, and they've in a sense been sent to you, right? Whether it, you know, it's a spouse, as you say.
Right.
Not everybody, you know, finds that they've got a problem.
I think everybody wants to manage their life better.
Uh-huh.
That may mean reducing their drinking but not giving it up. It may mean not getting caught again.
That's...
Management is management.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's any way you can skin the cat.
Right. A good therapist will roll with the client's goals.
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly today, drug abuse is the big one, I suppose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what about, I mean, and so we've done programs on drug abuse several times. What about food abuse, right? I mean, this country is full of people who eat too much. Partially because food is so cheap, and then when you go to a restaurant, they give you too much.
And you can't go cold turkey with food, pun intended.
So do you deal with that very much?
There are studies being conducted up at Brown University working with diabetics and looking at ways to help them change their eating habits as well as monitor their blood sugar.
Okay.
And so this notion of change generalizes way past substances. It can be addressing exercise. Change is change. So yes, this does work, and there is this general pattern again of what is said in therapy is telling us something about what will happen later.
So where's the future? I mean, you've sort of given a very compelling story about how it's useful right now and is used right now, and you've got a certain predictive capacity. But what do you see? Because you're a young man. You've got another 10, 15 years, 20 years of this stuff. What's the goal?
I think the goal is to provide or arm the therapist and other health policy professionals with as much information about the client, the patient that they can get that is naturally available that will help them tune their future therapeutic needs. Or as one of my colleagues at Columbia says, it's good for clinicians to have as many arrows in their quiver as they can have. And one is the talk in that simple session context. Another important direction for this to go is how a patient talks during the session is an indicator as to how well trained the therapist is.
So it's just dragging out the conversation to get where you're really wanting to go. It's like doing a radio interview to keep it reasonably interesting.
So it looks like it will be useful for in psychotherapy and training and in the concept of change for a long time, hopefully.
In general terms, modern society is not geared to many conversations. I mean, I just see it with my children, my students, you know, my colleagues, all right? There's a lot of pithiness now because these damned, you know, messages, text messages, emails. You know, and I can't tell you how disappointed I am at just – if I want to have a communication with a faculty member who's just two doors down, it's like pulling 10 hen's teeth to get them to come and talk. But they'll spend, you know, an hour backwards and forwards with short pieces which don't really fit the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're dealing with this in conversation, I guess there's a point at which the person who you're quote-unquote your patient – I know it's not a patient, but
–
is quite delighted to actually sit down and have a talk. It's rather like going back to the old days when you'd go and chat to your vicar or your priest or whatever.
Ironically, therapy may be more beneficial in the future just for the simple reason of having a person in front of you.
Right.
You know, flesh and blood means a lot.
So, in fact, I've read about protocols where they're trying to do this, but not with voices, not with conversation, but where they're going to type questions. I mean, in fact, this is sort of a way to avoid the complication of two personalities looking at each other and hearing the inflection on the voice, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you would ask a question by typing it in and they got to type it back. That seems to me sterile. And how on earth do you get the subtlety? Because you're having to think about it to type.
You don't, and people can hide behind their keyboards.
Yes.
Or their smartphones. And I think the best way to think about social media in that regard is that hopefully in the future that may be an entry point for someone who would not walk into a therapist's office, but they'll start texting.
Right. It's like going into the shallow end.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you
just
feel comfortable there. And then once you've got there, then a conversation might come. That's a long, drawn-out process.
It is.
Very expensive process.
But it's a start.
Yes.
And there's Skype along the way. You know, you can do all kinds of things that way. Whatever seems to work. It's not sort of this old notion of psychotherapy of reciprocal inhibition that if you're afraid of an elevator.
Say that again. It sounds wonderful.
Reciprocal inhibition. Right. If you are afraid of elevators,
yes,
you will address the issue by one day walking towards the elevator and pressing the button, but then going down the staircase or not using the elevator at all. The next day, you walk up to the elevator, you press the button, you wait for the door, and then you walk away from the elevator. The third day, same thing, walk in the elevator, leave the elevator quickly, I hope, and eventually by the end of the week, you will be riding that elevator.
This is a therapeutic
ploy? Reciprocal inhibition has been around for decades.
Well, my sister hates to fly. But, you know, they're not going to let her get up to the aeroplane and, you know, then walk away again. But it's an interesting concept. And it is used and it is successful.
It breaks down defenses.
And it was called again what?
Reciprocal inhibition.
Reciprocal inhibition. I like it. I like the words you guys used, you know, psychotherapeutics and goodness knows what. And it's wonderful.
Wordplay.
We've come to the end of a very interesting Science Studio program, Paul. So we've been talking to Paul Amrine, professor of psycholinguistics at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. It's been a lot of fun, Paul, and I think we might see you down here again. I think you've got many reasons to be visiting to and fro.
Definitely.
We'll follow this up.
Excellent.
And in fact, maybe I'll let you do some therapy with me. I don't quite know what problem I got to get rid of, but I'm sure there is one.
Sounds
and
good.
We'd like to thank Norma Martinez for being there in the studio, putting it together so it sounds delightful and cogent, and we thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Paso del Norte Health Foundation is accepting proposals for funding of smoke-free initiatives. Organizers want evidence-based programs that can help reduce tobacco use in the El Paso region. Deadline for proposals is January 10th. A workshop will be held this Monday, November 11th. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Sierra Providence Health Network.